Welcome to Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin Public Television original production, adapted for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Comfort. These stories were recorded in the natural settings of the regions that Native people have called home for centuries. Tribal members share their challenges, triumphs, and time-honored traditions that have shaped their vibrant communities across generations. Today, we hear the histories of the Red Cliff Ojibwe and the Stockbridge Munsee Mohicans. By the shore of Lake Superior, Marvin Defoe and Andrew Goki share stories of the Red Cliff Ojibwe. They tell of a history that goes back to the Ice Age and of preparing their children for the future. And then, by the rapids of the Red River, Kimberly Veely shares the story of the Mohicans who were forcibly removed to Indiana, where they joined with the Munsee Band before their final relocation. Red Cliff Ojibwe and Stockbridge Munsee Mohican history, coming up after the news. Welcome to Tribal Histories. First, the oral tradition of the Red Cliff Ojibwe people from Marvin Defoe and Andrew Goki. We join Marvin Defoe and his daughter Jewel on the shore of Lake Superior.
Hey, Jewel. You know what happened to me last night?
What?
When I came out here last night, I walked behind here and I listened out in the water and I heard them frogs talking. Did you know that they were talking?
No.
And I heard them frogs. I heard one frog way on the other side of that water over there, and he was saying, come on over. Come on over.
That was probably just a toad.
It was. It was a great big bullfrog, and I went and seen it, and it had a great big belly. And he kept saying, come on over. Come on over. Come on over. And you know who he was talking to?
Yeah.
Way over here, on the other side, I seen some little itty-bitty frogs. They're about this big. And they were sitting on the other side, so I figured that that big frog was talking to them little frogs. So that big frog would say, come on over, come on over. Them little frogs, they'd say, too deep, too deep, too deep, too deep. So then that big frog would say, come on over. Come on over. Little frog, too deep, too deep, too deep. So then that big frog, he said, go around, go around, go around. That's them frogs, they were talking to each other.
Andrew Goki speaking Ojibwe.
Me tum, the dozen dun bungi. Busy by Ashi, when any indigenous cause. We know what busy key and they go, Makwa do them on a snobby and dow. Me o ma, Mishkwabe Kongish gonna gunning and doonji ba. Umaya, and ge a binda skujige, every day get you gumming. Uma, I say ma kean. Kawe. I have two names. One is a whirlwind man, and the other one is the buffalo.
My name is Marvin Defoe. I'm located here in way northern Wisconsin. But if you go a little further yet, I'm located in a community called Mesquabicong. That's what we say in our language, Mesquabicong, a place that's red. English, you'd say Red Cliff.
Some of what I'm gonna talk about, you know, it's a part of our oral history, not written down in any books. If it is written down, we don't pay too much attention to it. But our history is a living history because it's passed from person to person. And it goes back so far that we don't even know how far back it goes. I only know a tiny bit, like a grain of sand that we see on the beach here. The depth and the scope of our knowledge is great, but each one of us only know a little bit. I made an offering of tobacco before we sat down here today. It's essential preparation. because I asked permission from the spirits. We're going to talk about things that happened a long time ago. We're going to talk about people that are passed away, stuff like that. When we do that carefully. We do that with respect and also with humility.
This earth has changed. What I'd like you to do is have an imagination and go back in time. Right here where I live, right here today in Red Cliff, go back 10,000 years. Our people, the Red Cliff people, it wasn't even a Red Cliff, there wasn't even a word Red Cliff. Way back then, walked upon this land 10,000 years ago. 12,000 years ago, probably right here in this spot. I don't think we could sit here because we'd be a half mile of ice on top of us. This land back then changed. That ice melted. There's a spot right here in Red Cliff, which is really high. Up on top of that is old time remnants. Thousands and thousands of years old of our people that lived there.
Our story is kind of like before the beginning, before anything existed, you know. Great Spirit had a vision and a dream, and that he saw everything that exists now in that dream. And there was a great vibration, and then that vision of the Creator was manifested in everything that we see. Creator made the animals and plants and human being, the physical world, and we were given original instructions on how to live. All people were given those instructions. The Native people, what's unique, I think, is that we still have that connection to our original teachings. And so that's kind of like our purpose is to, in a sense, to help teach the rest of humanity how to live, how to get along in some respects. For example, with the environment and taking care of the water and things of this sort. So they say that there was a man amongst the Ojibways. We lived in the east, and he had a dream about the coming of a non-Indian people to Turtle Island. That's what we call North America. And he foresaw that we were going to have lots of difficulties ahead. This is before the arrival of Columbus or anybody. We had to go. And the reason they said is we're going to be able to retain things that's going to be useful in the future. And so we started moving this way. And it was a long, long journey, several stops, and we ended up coming around Lake Superior on both sides. People were undecided by Bawating, I believe. Sault Ste. Marie, they split up. We met up on this end of the lake. Just great water here, Gitche-Gumming. He chose as a homeland this special place called Maning-Wainakoning. Today they call that Madeline Island. And that became the economic, spiritual, cultural, political center of the Ojibwe nation, the Anishinaabe people around the Great Lakes.
Do you know how many Chippewa villages and reservations there are? Red Cliff is one. There's 153. Generally, you'll find them 153 all around Lake Superior. Six in Wisconsin, Chippewas in Wisconsin. You go to Minnesota, you'll have more. You go to Michigan, you'll have more. You go to Canada up that way, there's more, 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 more. You know, my people didn't put those boundaries there.
When the non-native people came here, the first ones were the French people. They wanted to trade for beaver skins. But the French, one thing about them is they did not, for the most part, you know, try to change our way of life too much. I think there was some missionary activity in that respect, but a lot of the French actually intermarried and became more Indian than we became French, so to speak, you know. Then the British were the next ones that came in. They took control from the French. I think back to our ancestors and I wonder what they thought about all these European powers jockeying for position in North America, because they never asked us what we thought. Eventually, with the American Revolution and all that, then we had the Americans. We never felt that we owned land. We never had that concept. About 1825, they asked us to go, all the tribes in this Great Lakes area were asked to go to Prairie du Chien. And down there, they did some military drills and they brought out cannons and they shot them off to show how powerful their army was, kind of to intimidate and impress the native people about what they could do. That was the first time it was a watershed moment in a history, not only of our people, but of all the tribes in this region, because they asked us to designate on a piece of parchment what land we owned. And for the first time, you know, we're kind of forced to do that. Because to us, it's like saying you owned a cloud in the sky. It just didn't make any sense to us. It was a very short time before they came back and they separated all the tribes. One by one, they were approached to cede their land, to give up their land. The first cession treaty is in 1837. And when they made that treaty, we thought they were asking for wood, trees, timber, to build homes. We could relate to that. They need timber to build homes. So we agreed with that. We came to find out over time that these were real estate transactions and that we gave up these huge tracts of land for a pittance, really. So in 1850, they made something called a removal order. Because of these treaties, it said that, you know, we gave up our land, we have nowhere to live. Right around this time, they were paying the annuities from these treaties, this $4 or whatever it was per person at La Pointe on Madeline Island.
And they tried to trick us into going to this spot in Minnesota. So they said, instead of getting your payments on Madeline Island, we'll give you your payments over here. It's in the fall time, cold. We'll have you get your payments by a place called Sandy Lake over there in Minnesota. So a lot of our people went from here. And they got there, no food, cold, nothing. And they said, well, we don't have it yet. You're gonna have to wait a little longer yet. So here it is, thousands of our people there in the middle of winter, no shelter, waiting, 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 waiting. Pretty soon they got fed up. Pretty soon a lot of them got sick too, and they started dying. They started coming their way back, and our chiefs sat down and they talked about that. What are we gonna do? They want us to go over there. Our chief decided, no, go in. We're not gonna move. We're gonna stay right here.
The Ojibways are very numerous people, but we had never went to war with the United States as a nation. We always try to get along. But that was the closest point where people were saying that if we go to Minnesota, we're gonna die over there. So if we're gonna die, we might as well die here. So they kind of took a stand and let it be known that we're willing to fight to stay here. And so that's where Bijiki comes in. He's known as Chief Buffalo. He's one of my ancestors, and I carry that name too, Bijiki. Buffalo was both a warrior and a diplomat, and he was known throughout Indian country. At this time, a pretty advanced age, over 90 years old.
So they started gathering their tools together, and they were going to make a trip and see the President of the United States. And part of their tools was a birch bark canoe, Wigwasajimat. That canoe is probably, I heard that it was around 26 feet long. And they prepare and they get all their provisions and make that canoe. And they also prepared for the journey, they prepared themselves. They asked the spirits, the relationships then that we had with the lake, with the water. And they made a tool that they're gonna bring with them to help talk to the President of the United States. And that was a pawgut, pipe. That was a pipe that they made just for that trip, just so they could sit down and talk to the President of the United States. So they went in that birch bark canoe and they traveled.
There was a special man who could do this at an advanced age to take this journey by canoe from La Pointe Madeleine Island and all the way to Sault Ste. Marie. They caught a steamship to Detroit, and from Detroit they caught a train to Buffalo, New York, and then to Albany, New York. And they ran out of money along the way, and they put themselves basically on exhibit for 10 cents a head and let people come and gawk at them, and then they collected enough money to get the train fare down to Washington, D.C. When they got to Washington, the Indian agent heard that they were coming because they sent word all along the way, like in Detroit, make them guys go home. They're not authorized to be coming over here. But Buffalo was a stubborn man too. There was a congressman from New York that asked him if he could be of assistance, and he arranged for them to have an audience with President Fillmore.
They went that evening, they went to see the President. They had that tool, that pawgut, and they used it. They used that tool, they used that pawgut. The President liked them, liked what happened so much. He said, "You come back tomorrow." Our Chief Buffalo, he went back the next day with his helpers there and sat down and talked with the President of the United States. And they made a mutual agreement. The President would rescind that removal order of all Native people moving west of the Mississippi if you remain peaceful on the land. So all that land, I have a right because of my ancestors, the agreement they made with the President of the United States to hunt, fish, and gather, et cetera, et cetera. Also with that, Chief Buffalo, he says, "How about if we have the little spots of land where we could just have it as our home? Some people call it reservation, I like to call it home, where our people can live there." And that is where Red Cliff came from, Bad River, Lac des Flambeaux, LCO, for Wisconsin, on that agreement with the President of the United States.
We were really poor up here. My father was born in a logging camp in Sand River. And my mother was raised up by her father, living off the land, picking berries, you know, doing what you had to do to make a living. And she once remarked, she said, "We never knew we were poor till they told us." Because I guess she was satisfied with how they lived.
We all have a connection to history. You know why? Because we all have the same relationship in us, and that is with the earth. On the earth sustaining us. See, we all relied on that. And today we still rely on the earth sustaining us. And we rely on the water, the air that we breathe. Things that are important, the food and what we're where we're getting that from. We thought it was very important to work with our kids, with our children, on not just learning in the classroom or looking in a book, but to take the children out in the woods and learn from nature, learn from touching the snow or touching the grass or, you know, maybe even just sitting out there letting the sun hit you. And also we feel it's important to teach our language. Shinabe Mowin, because if you work with your language, what we found out is you're going to learn who you are. We also found out you're going to learn your history. You're going to learn words, and it tells about life.
When I was a kid, we used to drink this water right out of the lake, and it was delicious, cold, clear. But we found out that the reserve mining was dumping asbestos taconite tailings directly into the lake. Besides that, we found out the Department of Defense had put toxic waste in barrels and dumped them. I think all of our people are really concerned about that kind of stuff. It's spiritually significant to us. There's spirits that live in this lake. It's a part of our oral history. It's part of our spirituality. It's part of our who we are. One, you know. And so we're trying to educate the non-native people to respect the water.
Our ancestors were very wise. Chief Buffalo, they're very wise. They had to make decisions on the survival up ahead, generations ahead. Now that was 163 years ago that meeting took place, thinking ahead, 163 years. We are faced today no different for the future ahead. The earth, there's something with the earth that's changing. I knew that years ago because I was told that it was coming. We're having those meetings now. What can we do so that our people can survive? So we decided, touch the earth, touch the trees, learn our language, learn how to gather food, learn how to grow food so that we can survive too, see? So that's why we're doing these things with the children, because when those Head Start children become Akawenzi, that's the elder. Don't know what to do. Well, none of us will be here. But we're planting that seed. See, we're helping and we're nurturing that for what's up ahead. That's the importance. It's even hard for me to describe it. And I thought, that's the only way I could describe it. It's the only way. Somehow we have to survive. together.
You're listening to Tribal Histories. The storytellers you just heard were Marvin Defoe and Andrew Gokey from the Red Cliff Ojibwe. Next, Stockbridge Munsee Mohican history from Kimberly Veeley. We join her first at the Mohican Historical Conference, issuing a proclamation honoring tribal elders.
On behalf of the Stockbridge Munsee Tribal Community, we have a proclamation in honor and recognition of Bruce Gadinus and Dorothy Davis, members of our community, tribal members, respected elders, who have taught us that we must resolve a fierce dedication to education, even in the face of any adversity. In honor and recognition of you two and your commitment to address the social injustices in society through education and understanding and practical wisdom, that's not here, that's me. And in honor of your lifetime commitment to our community through your dedication to the historical committee and its work, as well as your efforts toward providing a forum for education on Mohican history through the annual Mohican History Conference. Now, therefore, the community declares that a feast will be held in your honor, celebration, and recognition.
You're listening to Tribal Histories. We now rejoin Kimberly Veeley sharing the story of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican.
Kolomalsi. Good morning. My name is Kim Veeley. I'm an enrolled member of the Stockbridge Munsee Tribe, otherwise known as the Mohicanuk, which means people of the flowing water. And I will begin with Kishalamokwin Elamiliang Yon Kwai Kish Kwik, which means thank you, Creator, for this beautiful day and the opportunity to share my tribe's story with others. We're not Aboriginal to Wisconsin. We are one of the, what is commonly known as one of the New York tribes, and originally occupied much of the land north of Albany all the way into Lake Champlain along the Hudson River, which is a large river that ebbs and flows with tides, is why my people are known as Mohicanuk, people of the flowing waters. The shortened version of that is Mohican. The Hudson River has many islands, and one of the islands, which is called Skodak Island, is one of our great council fires, and that is where our ancestors met and took care of business for the tribe. It's where the sachems resided and was the center of the government, basically, until the Dutch came, and it's believed that my ancestors were among those that greeted Henry Hudson when he first came up the Hudson River, helped him and his crew survive. And it was during that time that diseases started to spread throughout the tribes in the upper New York area, including my tribe, continuing factions and warring between the Mohawks and the Mohicans resulted in a dramatic loss of members. Eventually, it was very difficult for some of the remaining bands to continue to survive in that area. We have historically had approximately three sachems in the tribe, which would be known as chiefs. One would be the chief of the people and deal with essentially issues that would be unique to just our tribe and our tribe's issues. And then we would usually have a spiritual sachem who would guide the tribe on a spiritual level and guide the other sachems in a spiritual way And then we also had basically what would be the international diplomat, if you will. And that sachem would be basically the chief among other bands of our tribe and other tribes. At the time, we had two sachems, Umpisheen and Kunkapot. They were approached by Scottish missionaries to missionize and stabilize the tribal membership and advocated for Christianization of the tribe, and I think convinced Umpisheen and Kunkapot that this might be a good idea for survival. Neither one of the chiefs wanted to bind the membership with that decision without first taking it back, had numerous meetings with the tribal members, and came to a decision that maybe this was best for the tribe to set up basically a reservation in western Massachusetts. And I don't think people really understand how difficult that is for people to leave your homeland. You know, that you've been there for thousands of years and to walk away from everything that's familiar to you to go someplace new. And this is about 1732, and at that time, two townships were set aside for our members. They actually became members of a town board, so to speak, and set up a mission school, set up a sawmill, set up a grist mill, and learned farming, became Christianized, and became educated. Some of the members started the Indian school, which I think is the predecessor to what is now Dartmouth College. The Berkshires, where they settled, is supposedly geographically similar to an area in England known as Stockbridge. So it was easy for people to always refer to us as the Stockbridge Indians. And so to this day, we carry that English name forward. But in our way and in our traditions, we're Mohicanucks. We lived fairly peacefully during that time in western Massachusetts until the American Revolution broke out. We have a significant history of fighting in wars, and our members chose to fight for the colonists. There are very significant battles that are commemorated involving many Stockbridge who sacrificed their lives during that time. And it was following the war that the men returned back to Stockbridge, Mass, and discovered that a lot of the missionaries and non-Indians had taken over the farms and the land, and the children and the elders and other members were pushed back into wigwams in the woods. There was a lot of struggle to regain that land. Petitions were filed with the territorial government of Massachusetts to no avail. And because it had such a devastating impact on the membership, the New York Oneida tribe invited the Stockbridge back to New York, where they had a reservation. So the membership moved back and were given a reserve within the New York Oneidas Reserve, which is known as Stockbridge, New York, and did the same thing again, set up a mission house, a school, set up a grist mill, get farming, built homes. And it wasn't long after that that the federal government's policy was to remove tribes from Aboriginal territory. There was a lot of tension between non-Indians and fights over the land. And the policies shifted then to move all of the eastern bands and eastern tribes west of the Mississippi. And the migration out of New York started in, I think, about 1819, 1820 to what is now Muncie, Indiana. And the Muncies had also promised us some land there as part of their treaty, but by the time some of our members got there to stake a claim, the Munsees had been deprived through another treaty of their treaty reservation. So both the Munsees and the Stockbridge were out and joined and moved to the next place, which was around Lake Winnebago, and that's where you get the Stockbridge Munsee Indians. And in fact, some of our members are from the Munsees. We were continuing to be forced west, and the tribe was really, really resisting that. And so, being the diplomats that they are, began to negotiate with the Menominee tribe directly for some kind of property to allow us a permanent settlement. And in fact, the Menominee tribe and the Stockbridge tribe reached agreement and submitted the agreement to Congress for ratification and approval, and it was denied. Congress then did get involved in establishing a reservation, and the reservation here in Wisconsin was established by a treaty of 1856. And so this is where we've been ever since. They built log homes. They had to clear the land. Workhorses pulling these huge roots and burning and clearing, and the toil that it took to move some of the boulders just to clear a field to plow and plant a garden. We set up the mission house, and we set up another school, and Electa Quinney, one of our members, opened the school up, and the tribe opened the school up to be a public school. And that was before Wisconsin was a state. So we stake her claim as being the first public school teacher of Wisconsin, which we're very proud of. She wrote a brief history of the tribe, and her father, John Quinney, wrote a brief history, and some of his speeches survive, and they're very eloquent. John was a sachem, made many trips back to New York for redress of the loss of our land in New York to no avail. And throughout the years, that's something that we carry with us from generation to generation. We have always been a very political people, politically active, never afraid to stand up for what we believe is right and just, and with a significant dignified eloquence. I think education has impacted, and that's also a very significant value in my tribe, to be educated, to educate our youth. And so we believe in education, and everywhere we've traveled along our many trails, one of the first things we've done is establish a school and get a teacher for the children. And I think along the way that's really helped to be the kind of diplomats that our ancestors proved to be. Some of their letters and speeches that I read now are amazing. I wish I could write half as well as they. I wish I could make these eloquent, compelling arguments and speeches that they made, but I'm really inspired by their words and their vision. And I think it's only through their vision that we really have survived as well as we have over the years, despite all of these things that worked against us. The federal government is what I call schizophrenic in their policies, and it depends on who's in political power, whether they want to see tribes survive and whether they don't, whether the goal is termination and assimilation. It changes with the wind. And we even realize that today throughout, you know, the 200, 300, 400 year history that we have working with federal and state governments, that it really depends on who's in political power as to what, how much sovereignty and how much respect you get nation to nation. But I think what people don't realize is the United States government set it up in the U.S. Constitution that tribes would be dealt with on a treaty basis, and that this was an issue for the federal government and not local and state governments to really address. And so when people talk about how unique tribes are, it's because of that legal history that we have and in being included in the U.S. Constitution. I think that the impact of colonization, Christianization, re-education, the boarding school, eliminate the language, beat the Indian out of you, and assimilate and be good people, dramatically had its impact on us as a people. And you see that wave going from east to west. The tribes that are the furthest point west had that experience in later years, but, you know, having first been introduced to the colonists so much earlier than the other tribes, you know, we have a longer history of being without. So our language all but died. And the history conference has always been about rediscovering ourselves through what's written and combining it with what's carried through oral traditions in our families. A lot of this was done where we were invited to attend by scholars in New York having the annual Mohican Conference. Some people, non-Indians, it's amazing. They live their entire lives just studying histories and traditions and things about our tribe. But it was really important, I think, for the History Committee to make corrections to some of the record and to really tell the story from our perspective. Because, I mean, it's our history. So I know people are really well-meaning, but it doesn't have the same sense of importance and truth as it is when it comes from the very people you're speaking about. So I think that's the most significant thing about our Mohican History Conference is majority, if not all, of the presenters were enrolled members who are rediscovering things about our tribe. A lot of the history kind of gets lost in time and movement and translation, but there is a lot of written work that's preserved that we can go back to and piece together and learn. So a lot of our culture is coming alive again after being repressed. You know, things have a way of just coming in a big circle, which is central to our beliefs and in everything we do.
Marvelous.
Our language, we're part of the Lenape family. We've started language camps. Some of our members are getting to the point where they can carry on conversations. Prayers are being said in the traditional language, and we brought our drums back. And the drum in our culture represents the heartbeat of life. And so to be part of a drum and to have a drum be part of everything that you do reminds you of how central it is. Everything is a circle. A drum is a circle of singers. There's power in a tornado, which goes in a circle. Robins and birds make their nests in circles. Life and death is a big circle, and our seasons are circular. Everything about our life is in a circle, if you think about it. And we are at the center of the circle as human beings. And so when we refer to bringing the drum back, there was a period of decades where the drum was pagan and it was a bad thing and you should not practice your religion, you should not speak your language, you need to be good Christians and speak English and cut your hair and assimilate. And this wasn't just taught. I mean, you were beaten as a human being if you did these things. So you have a couple of generations of our ancestors who were afraid and couldn't. And you lose that when it's not passed from your grandparents to your aunties and uncles and to the children. And that's been resurrected. And there are more and more people going back to the drum and going back to those basic beliefs, because that's what makes you whole as a person. If you live what we call in the traditional red way, it means that you recognize that you're part of a greater circle that you're interrelated and related to everything around you and about you. Everything, your environment, the air, the water. Water is considered the blood of Mother Earth. And to not have that sacredness in everything that we do is heartbreaking. But the fundamental issue is our polluting our earth and the waters that we rely on to drink and the air that we breathe. And this goes back to, you know, those things that we need to survive as a people, as a human being, not just as a tribe, but as human beings. And until we understand and protect all those relationships, we'll die. We'll die. I consulted with our historic committee members and elders in the community, and I asked them, as the representative for the tribe, what would you like the message to be that I carry? And it's always very simple, that we survive, that the last of the Mohicans that Fenimore Cooper talked about is not true. We still live, and people need to know that. I think it's hugely significant that we survived against all odds and that we know how to survive. If you don't have food, you make food. You hunt, you fish, you gather. And so our land is so central to how we live, because if gaming were to go away or something catastrophic would happen and we are all off the grid, we have land here that we know, as a people, we could survive. And that's so important, because I think we always lose track of what's really, really important in our lives, and it's just basic food, being together, breathing clean air, drinking clean water. And these are fundamental values that go to the core of who you are as a people. And it's not just for our tribe, it's human beings. Our very survival depends on it. And I think that's something that we carry. We're a spiritual people. You know, Christianization, some are very Christianized still to this day. We have faith. Some, you know, believe in the Creator. Some believe in God. We have different, we represent different religions. But, you know, that spirit and that faith, I think, also carries us as human beings. So our emblem is called Many Trails, to exemplify all of the different removals that we've had from east to west and all the times that we had to just set up and make homes and then leave. And you'll see in the Many Trails sign the sign of a cross, which indicates our Christianization. We have a lot of teachers in our tribe today, and they've been very active in developing curriculum to teach children about the tribe's history. And one of the exercises they have is for the children to move in the classroom from station to station and start something and not be able to finish it and be told, now you need to move to the next station. And the children, you'll see, I'm not done, or I'm not finished, or why do I have to move? And it's like, nope, just move. We said move, move now. And it really illustrates for the children to understand what that's like to move, move, move. Redo, redo, start over. So there is a resilience there, and it's a strength, probably from our faith and knowing the basics on how to live. And we're reminded of that all the time. Just a couple months ago, one of our elders came to open session at a tribal council meeting and said, what are your plans as our leaders if something were to happen and our grid shut down? Remember, we need to survive. So it's part of our planning, you know. We're ready. Bring it on.
Stockbridge Muncie Mohican History was funded in part by Irene Danielle Kress, Francis A. and Georgia F. Ahrens Fund of the Community Foundation for the Fox Valley Region, EVU Foundation, Ron and Patty Anderson, Ira and Aneva Riley Baldwin, Wisconsin Idea Endowment, National Endowment for the Humanities, and Friends of Wisconsin Public Television.
This has been part three of Tribal Histories, a Wisconsin history project by Wisconsin Public Television and Wisconsin Historical Society. It was produced and edited by Mick Dirks. The storytellers this hour were Marvin Defoe, Andrew Goki, and Kimberly Veely. Sound design by Tom Nanas. Production assistance was by Donna Crane and Jake Corey. Director of production is Kathy Beeson. This program was adapted for radio by Jennifer Dargan, Tom Blaine, and Joe Hartke. You can find the video for this program at wpt.org/tribalhistories.